Well, let me give you an official Harvest welcome to 2019. Hard to believe that we are already on that spot of entering a new year. I'm really pumped about our track for messages and teaching over the next few months. I'll be telling you some more about that coming up, so stay tuned for that. I'm not going to talk about it here this morning, but we're going to start the year in this text in Philippians chapter 3. And I'm excited about what I think this passage is saying this morning for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's right up the alley of what I perceive to be the foundations for vibrant, successful Christian living. And so I like talking about that. I think it's particularly appropriate as we enter a new year to be talking about successful Christian living and some of these foundations for that. In fact, I hope, we'll hint at this a little bit later, but I hope that the message and the conversation, the teaching that we have this morning, I hope that it will start maybe some conversations with some of you about some of the things that we're talking about. I'll come back to that in a minute. So that's the first thing. It's right up the alley of these foundations. And the second thing is, I get to focus on and use two of my favorite words. This last week, I think I told you that our family was all together. My son and daughter-in-law and baby were here from Bangkok, Thailand. My daughter in college is here from the States. So our whole family was together. And, you know, in that type of a setting, I've told a lot of people it was wall-to-wall Waltons in our place. And a lot of conversation, like you had, around the tables and all kinds of interesting things that come up when you have five children, all very different in the ways that they think. But we had one supper time where my oldest son is an English teacher in Bangkok, and he asked a question. This might seem really weird to you, and it does to me too, except in the context, it was very funny and interesting. He asked the question to our family of what our favorite words were. I mean, an English teacher maybe says something like that. So he asked what our favorite words were, and it was sort of funny to listen to each one, you know, make up or share. I mean, we had somebody said lollipop. It's kind of an interesting word when you think about it, lollipop. And magnanimous. And I'm still not sure I can say this right. Ignominy, is that right? All of these are just interesting sounding words. And they show some of the personality of our family just because they're making up words like that. But I actually had a head start in this because I was thinking about a couple words for this Sunday. And so I talked about two words that I've loved for a long time. In fact, I'm going to give you some definitions here. The first one is the word quest. Quest is a great word. And the definition is a journey in search of adventures, as those undertaken by knights errant in medieval times. Heroic expedition in search of a particular object as the quest of the golden fleece. Right? That's a good word, isn't it? Quest. I like that word. And I also like the word passion. The definition of passion, or this definition, is it implies a strong emotion that has an overpowering or compelling effect. Implies emotions of burning intensity, a constant glow of feeling, intense enthusiasm for an object or cause, usually displayed in vigorous and an untiring activity in its support. Passion and quest. And when you put these two words together, like we're going to do this morning, it gives us some ideas of, I've termed it this way, it describes a sense of focus and a direction. And they imply real commitment to single objective. All right, so these are power words, right? That's probably partly why I like them. They say something just in the verbalizing of them. They say something that feels like it has weight and significance to them. So let me tell you why I love these words and why I'm talking about this morning. And really, most importantly, how they relate to the text that we're looking at here in Philippians chapter 3. I don't know if it's because of the way that I'm wired or maybe some a little bit of my coaching background, but I've always been interested in what motivates a person. I don't know if you've thought about that much, but I actually have over the course of time. Why people make the choices that they do. What compels someone to do their best or to give their all? As any good coach knows, in fact, it's the same as any good teacher knows or any people manager knows, people are motivated in different ways. Some are just naturally motivated. As a coach, you'll see this. As a teacher, you see this. As a people manager, you notice this. Some people just have an internal fire that drives them to excel. And you don't necessarily have to do anything for them. They just sort of have it internally. But most of us, in fact, all of us, are motivated also externally in different ways. And depending on the person, depending on the personality, we have different motivations. Some people, if you're coaching them, if you're teaching them, some students, they're motivated by encouragement. And every encouraging word that you give them, you can kind of tell it just raises them up and they want to push harder and go further. Some are motivated by challenge. You can kind of get in their face a little bit and push them and say, you know, I believe in you. You can do this. And here's something that you could accomplish if you really gave yourself to this. Some people are motivated by rewards. All right? Some people are motivated, frankly, by fear or punishment. All right? There's all kinds of other things that we could talk about. And it's really important if you're a leader of people in any way to think about what helps this person to move forward or to give more, because everybody's different. And if you approach somebody in one way and they're actually wired differently, you can actually demotivate them. So motivation's important for everything. It's important for you. It determines why you do what you do and how much effort you're going to give to a certain task. So when I was a young guy, in my 20s, I started to read some things about this topic of motivation. I read some secular things, sort of business type books. And then, frankly, a big part of this is I read a lot of biographies. I read biographies as I was a kid, and maybe some more pointed or purposeful biographies in sort of that early kind of formation time of my mind in the 20s and thinking about life and future. We're trying to put some pieces together. I read a lot of biographies, and in them I started asking questions like this. Well, what motivated that person that accomplished such significant things? What was it that drove them? Why does this person that basically has some of the same giftings and talents and abilities as that person, what is it about that one that's made them successful or driven or really pursuing something that they've found to be real profitable? Didn't take long to find out that the answer was fairly simple. And it has to do with this motivation word. It's the same in both the secular and the spiritual world. And that is that the people who have been impact players in their world have been people who have clearly defined their big purpose in life. They know exactly what they wanted to do, and they're consumed with fulfilling that purpose. So we're going to say it this way. We're going to talk about this. The people in life who really make a difference have a way of narrowing things down. They have the ability to focus and sort of give targeted energy in one consuming area. It ties in with our word quest. It ties in with this idea of people of passion. And we could give lots of illustrations of this. Historically, we could talk about Alexander the Great, right? He was consumed with conquering the world, very young age. Columbus, who was just convinced, right, that the earth was round and that the Orient could be reached by sailing west across the Atlantic Ocean. We could talk a lot about a lot of Christian heroes like Martin Luther and John Wesley and William Carey and Hudson Taylor and D.L. Moody and Billy Sunday, and we could name all kinds of other people. And if you read their biographies, and if you ask the question, what is it about this person that allowed them to be so used of God, you're going to find, I mean, it's not hard to see, I mean, it just kind of jumps out of the pages and the stories of their life that there are people that were just sort of consumed with some idea or some burden or very clear focus. So we want to talk about this text. Paul, the apostle who wrote the book of Philippians that we're going to study this morning, was a guy like this. And you talk about somebody who impacted his world. Here was a guy with great passion. He evidenced it before he became a believer. Read the first chapters of the book of Acts. And then he clearly evidenced that after God got a hold of his life and changed his course, he was a guy with passion, and he communicates this passion in every ounce of his life. And here's what he says in Philippians chapter 3. We're going to start in verse 10 and go down a few verses here. See if you can read and hear the passion of this guy, the Apostle Paul. He says, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death. If by any means I might attain unto the resurrection of the dead, not as though I had already attained, either were already perfect, but I follow after, if that I may apprehend that for which also I am apprehended of Christ Jesus. Brothers, I count not myself to have apprehended. I haven't arrived, but this one thing I do. Forgetting those things are which behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Hey, make no mistake about it. I mean, here was a guy with a passionate life quest. It's this thing that literally consumed his life in this idea that I may know him, that I would know Christ. We're going to walk down through this text this morning. Actually, I'm going to tell you where we're going both this morning and this evening. When I first came to this text and sort of planned out the idea that I felt God leading us to talk about this morning, my focus, honestly, was on the end of these verses, 13 and 14. In fact, I early on wrote sort of a little bit of a skeleton outline of that as being the main point of this morning's message, and then tying in some other areas tonight. But as I dug into this, I started working on just sort of an introduction that was based out of verse 10, and in the process of that, I couldn't get any further than that. So this morning, I really believe God's led us to spend our time just in the beginning of this little passage. We're going to just talk about verse 10. And it's going to be different. It's not kind of a very succinct outline. It's actually just some introductory thoughts to Philippians 3, 10 through 14. You'll see that here in a minute. Four different things. And then that's going to lead us to, we will get to that text at the end tonight. We're going to come back and talk about some specific things about this one thing I do that comes out of the end of this of these verses. Does that make sense with you? That's what we're planning to do here. So here's sort of the introductory thoughts, these four things, and that's all we're going to talk about this morning. Number one, Paul is talking about more than an intellectual knowledge. All right, and I'm saying that in reference to this key phrase that we're going to focus in on, where he says, that I may know him. All right, he's talking about more than an intellectual knowledge. The word know is a specific kind of knowledge in the original reading. Make sure that you hear this, because this is going to be the basis of everything that we say. It is a knowledge based on experience. It's a knowledge based on experience. And it's a very important distinction. It's the difference between knowing someone by name and the way that you know somebody well, like your husband or your wife or your brother or your sister. This is a simple illustration, but this is really what it is. So let's say that you and I are talking, and you bring up some name of somebody that's here on the island, and I've met them, and you say, do you know so-and-so? And I say, yes. And then, a little bit later in the conversation, and this is going to sound kind of weird, but it makes it as most clear for the illustration. A little bit later in the conversation, you say, do you know Faith Walton? And I say, yes. All right. You use the same word. Do you know so-and-so, this person that I've met? And you said, do you know Faith Walton, this person that I know very well? All right. And I said yes to both of them. I know them both. But believe me, I know them in very, very different ways. All right. This know is a very specific word, and it's the know that's attached with experience. It's attached with relationship. So what Paul is talking about here, and I want you to get this, he says, my main goal in life, my life quest is this, that I may know him. And it's not talking about an acquaintance with the facts of who Christ is. It's not even talking about some sort of conviction of their reality. It's not saying even that I believe in Christ, in Jesus Christ. I believe in him. This is more than that. And I want to talk about this a little bit. This is an experience word. It's a relationship word that I think brings up some important questions for us. I want to talk about it. There's a guy named Tim Stafford. He wrote a very transparent book called Knowing the Face of God. And in this book, he gives this personal testimony in the introduction. I'm actually going to read a longer section of his introduction because it really helps us to sort of frame what we're talking about here. I wonder if there will be those of you here that are going to relate to what Tim Stafford had to say in this book, Knowing the Face of God. Tim grew up in a Christian home, became a believer early in life. He says by his testimony that he was very shy, but he went off to college and found there for the first time in his life other Christians his age who were equally interested in spiritual things. And this is what he says. I did not make the connection at the time, but now I think it was this very delight in Christian fellowship that made me look at my life with increasing despair. I had awakened to a deep enjoyment of Christian brothers and sisters, and I could not help longing for the same awakening with God. I was supposed to, quote, hear his voice in a 2,000-year-old book. I was supposed to, quote, talk with him in prayer. But when I read the Bible, I heard no voices. And my prayers often seemed more like talking to myself. My sense of his presence was never intense enough to form absolute proof of God. And other people's experiences were, well, other people's. One inky, blustery night when the wind blew the tree's arms high into the air, I walked for miles asking God again and again to simply show himself to me. I did not want to work up a feeling of God. I wanted God to break in on me. He did not. I heard no voice, saw no lights in the sky. I went home to my dorm room and went to bed, and I survived. I did more than survive. I grew, but I did not stop longing for God to be unquestionably real, real to me. I don't want to give the impression that my faith was utterly dry. I didn't lack for intellectual satisfaction or for demonstrations of God's power. I saw him changing lives. On a human level, Christianity was more than I'd hoped for. It was the human to God level I felt shaky about. I wanted more. I've come to realize that I was not alone in my longing. It's just that such questions usually aren't voiced. When they are, when the conversation comes to the subject of knowing God, listeners grow suddenly quiet and attentive. For a long time, I thought this was disapproving silence. I now know it is the silence that falls on a room of hungry people when someone talks about food. What Tim Safford is saying is that his experience was that he felt the blessing of Christian fellowship, and he longed for that kind of intimate fellowship and relationship with God, and he felt like he couldn't find it. God didn't break into his life in some way that he thought and hoped and expected. And he wondered, is there more? And when we talk about knowing God, it's one thing to talk about knowing the attributes of God and knowing, you know, the details and the doctrines of God. But Paul is talking about here is knowing God with experience and with relationship. And Paul's saying, I want that. I want it more. It's my overwhelming, consuming passion in life, my quest. A lot of years ago, Dr. J.I. Packer wrote a very famous book called Knowing God. Probably most of you have heard of this book. It's very popular. I heard someone say that it sold like insurance on a sinking ship. I mean, it was very, very popular, sold, you know, around the world. If you know anything about the book and really think about it, it's actually pretty surprising that that book sold as well as it did. Because the book is really a theology of the attributes of God. And in fact, there's really no interesting stories that are part of it. There's no compelling illustrations. It really is a theology of the attributes of God. And I want to tell you, theology books don't usually sell that well. I mean, there's a lot of theology books out there. None of them have sold, and some really, really good ones, very excellent ones, none of them have sold like J.I. Packer's Knowing God. There's a theory out there. I'd probably agree with this theory. And that is that this book sold based on its title and its introduction. Because there's this vast, unfed hunger among Christians to know God, to know him intimately, to know him personally. And we talk a lot about having a personal relationship with God, but for most Christians, that concept simply means salvation. So we see it in terms of, before I became a Christian, I wasn't a part of the family of God. And so we talk with people about having a relationship with God, and we really see it as I became a Christian and I became part of his family. I now have a relationship. I am God's son. I am God's daughter. And that's sort of where it stops. And it's great. It's awesome. I love those terms. Please understand this. I'm not being critical of those terms. We need that relationship, that familial relationship with Jesus Christ. But I think Paul's talking about something more than that. So if you're tracking with me, I'm hoping that you're saying, like Paul, how can I know Jesus like this? I don't want to settle just for the relationship like I know theologically and positionally that I am a son of God or I'm a child of God. I'm an heir to the family of God. I think the Bible wants more. I think the Bible says something about this relationship that's real, that means something, that there's a connection to it, an identification. So you're serious about your spiritual walk, and you might say, like Tim Safford says, I want more. What do? Where do you go? And I really think, I'm hoping, I'm praying, that what we're going to say in the next 15 minutes or so is going to help with this question. I hope that it does. I'm praying that it does. Here's the third thing. We will only know him like this, in this experience way, when two things happen. This is exactly what verse 10 says. Number one, when we experience the magnitude of his overcoming power in our personal lives. That's the power of his resurrection. That's a long sentence. It probably doesn't mean a lot to you, but I hope by the time we're done, it means a lot. When we experience the magnitude of his overcoming power in our personal life, and number two, when we experience the fellowship of participation in his sufferings, Paul calls this the fellowship of his sufferings. All right, here's what this looks like. You will not learn to know Christ in this experiential relationship, in this experiential way. You will not learn to do this by praying about it, by hoping for it, by doing Bible studies on it, even by talking about it with your friends. All of those things are good. All of those things will help you to know about God. All of those things will help you to know the attributes of God. All of these things are good. They're foundational for your Christian life. But it will not meet this need that I think Paul's talking about. All of those things build your intellectual knowledge. Paul already had that. Right? Paul had the intellectual, the doctrinal, the foundational knowledge of Jesus Christ. What he is saying is that he wants more. And this is how he expects to see it, by experiencing the magnitude of his overcoming power in our personal lives, the power of his resurrection. Power is an interesting word. It's the word for dynamite, dunamis. You can hear that. It literally means to blow through something, to overcome resistance. It's like the dynamite that's used to tunnel a hole through a mountain or through a cliff. It's talking about this. Listen, whatever obstacles you have in your life, whatever resistance that you can identify in your spiritual life, whatever challenges in your life, whatever impossible situations, anybody here have anything like that? Don't raise your hand. I hope you all would. If you were to list down the things that you know right now, and probably some of you walked in here and you're like overwhelmed with some of the mountains that you're facing in your life that just seem impossible. Some of the situations that you have that you just can't see any way around them, and they're overwhelming you. As you're sitting here this morning, you just feel the weight of these situations in your life. Maybe you've got some work situation that you just see no solution to. Maybe some relationship in your life that is just so broken, and you have tried and you've tried and you've tried to somehow fix and restore whatever that relationship is, and you're sitting here and you're feeling like, man, that thing is just overwhelming. It is a mountain, an uncrossable mountain in my life. Maybe you're here this morning and your marriage is floundering. You have had the same broken conversation with your spouse over and over and over, the same conflict, the same hurts, and you're just like, this is impossible. And there is no hope. Or maybe there's some sort of overwhelming habit in your life that's just sort of gripped your life and your decisions and your choices. And no matter how hard you've tried to overcome this habit of anger or drugs or alcohol or whatever it is, you've tried so hard to overcome this and it just feels like you can't get past it. Maybe it's a financial situation that's staring you right in the face right now. You can hardly think about anything else because you don't know any way around the financial mountain. I don't know what the obstacles and the challenges are in your life, but I know that you have them. And it's looming like a mountain. It just feels like there's no way over it or around it. And you feel like you're overwhelmed. Listen, and you call out to God, and He rescues you. Stay with me here. It may not be immediately. It may take a lot longer. That mountain may loom in your life for a long time. But if you have had the experience someplace in your life where some large obstacle, some challenge, some overwhelming mountain in your life that you felt like there was no hope for it to ever be removed, and sometime in time God steps into your life and He removes, He rescues, He carries you, He upholds you. Maybe He doesn't take it away, but He walks with you through that valley, and He does something for you that nobody else can do. And when God steps into your life like that, and His power is unleashed on the obstacle in your path that seems so immovable, and just like dynamite, God's power blows a hole in the mountain that seemed so impossible. This is what Paul says. He says, then you will know. Then you will know that there's nothing else in this world that can do that kind of thing for you, that can unleash that kind of power in your world, except God Himself. And then you will come to know Christ in this experiential, this personal way. Paul says you won't get it by just trying to figure it out. You'll only know Him. You'll only experience Him when you walk through the resurrection power with Him. You know, Faith and I have some mountains. We've had some mountains in our lives, just like you. We've had some obstacles and some challenges, and we've had some miracles. I'm not talking about miracles like healing or turning the water into wine. I'm not talking about those kind of miracles. But let me tell you, for Faith and I, they are as miracles as can be, where God stepped into our lives in things that we saw as completely impossible. No hope, no way around this. And in that time, God walked with us. And He walked beside us. And at some places, it was like His resurrection power, like dynamite, blew a hole in a mountain that we never, ever thought we could ever see around. And you want to know when God does that? Then we begin to know Him, right? We begin to know him. So Paul says we'll only know him like this when we experience the magnitude of his overcoming power in our personal lives, the power of his resurrection, and two, when we experience the fellowship of participation in his sufferings. The fellowship, Paul says, of his sufferings. Paul is probably talking specifically about persecution suffering, which is really a remarkable thing when you think about the brutality of the persecution that these Christians endured. Paul is saying to us his desire to know Christ was so consuming that he welcomes the fellowship of Jesus' suffering. Paul says, I welcome the persecution. I mean, you think about what was happening in that first century. Paul says, I welcome that because in that, then I will come to know Christ because I'll be to fellowship in his sufferings. It's a remarkable statement. So most of us will never face persecution for our faith, though it's not that far away from us out here. Actually, there are some places I could tell you about. You probably know some places not that far, not that many miles from here, where Christians are facing real persecution for their faith. Most likely that won't be our calling, but I don't think that it's unfaithful to the meaning of the text to say that God is likely going to bring all of us through suffering of some sort or another. And in this place of suffering, if we only see it from the human pain that it causes, because that's real, every one of us, we're going to experience that kind of suffering, and it's going to produce some searing pain, human pain. But if we only see it as nothing more than that human pain and heartache, then that's all it will be. Some of us will have less of it, some of us will have more, but we'll all experience it. In the coming year, in 2019, some of our church family will face suffering. It will happen. What Paul is saying is that if we share with him in this suffering, if we walk with him through it, if we share the path with him and allow him to walk beside us, that's the fellowship word, right? That's what fellowship means. We allow him to walk beside us through the pain, very real, through the suffering. And if in the midst of this suffering, we allow God's Spirit to use it to help us become more like Jesus was in his suffering? Isn't that what it says? And the fellowship of his sufferings helping to make us conformable unto him as he was in his death? The ESV says, as we share his sufferings, becoming like him. Walking through the suffering that we face in this life with him, fellowshipping, sharing it, and so in that process, becoming like him. If we experience that, and only if we experience that, then will we know Christ in this experiential, personal relationship way. We're going to talk some more about this idea next week out of Romans chapter 8. But you know, I've talked and walked with a lot of people through paths of suffering. And some, when you're talking with them, you can feel those hard days just sort of hardening their hearts and a bitterness creeping in, sort of spiritual and emotional calluses that form, and it makes sense. We understand it. Many of us have walked through some very, very hard days, some difficult days. And then there's others that have had the privilege of walking alongside through suffering, real suffering, heavy. And In the process, the glow of Christ's likeness just shines through more and more. In fact, it's an amazing thing to me that for some people, the deeper the pain, the more brilliant the glowing of Jesus Christ shines through their life. Not that their suffering was any easier, but they experienced the fellowship of His suffering, right? It wasn't just they went through the human pain, but Paul says that in these things, God would like to walk beside us and sometimes carry us. And when we allow Him to do this work, then we come through that time and we've experienced something with Jesus Christ that we never would have experienced before. It's knowing Christ. It's the fellowship of His suffering that helps to make us more conformable to His Son. And I think that's the point. Practically, powerfully, Paul says, if you want to know Christ, and Paul says, and I do, if you want to know Him in this deep, experiential, relational way, you won't find it in a book. You won't find it even by praying. You won't find it by talking to your Christian friends. You will only find it when we experience the magnitude of His overcoming power in our personal lives. When God does something to remove a mountain that only He could do. The power of His resurrection. And when we experience the fellowship of participation in His sufferings. Let me add one more thing before we bring this home. I'll come back to this tonight. This is really just the fourth thing that leads us to tonight. But it's this. Paul's desire to know Christ drove him to reject spiritual complacency and seek hard after Christ. That's verses 12 through 14. We'll come back and talk about that tonight. Here's how I want to close this morning. I wonder how many of you can relate to what I'm talking about. As I've been preparing this, praying about it, thinking about it, I understand that it's possible that some here, you know, you're just not going to be, it's just not going to relate to you for whatever reason. I don't know why that is. I believe, though, that there are some, maybe a lot, that would say, boy, I feel a little bit of that. I've had those kinds of questions before. I love God. I'm a believer. I'm so moved by the relationships with other believers. I know I'm a child of God, but there have been some times when I've asked this question, what does it mean to really know Him, like have this personal relationship? I haven't felt that. I don't know that. And maybe I can break it down to you this morning a little bit into age groupings. I don't know if this will make sense to you. That's how I'm going to do it anyway, all right? We got a bunch of young people here at Harvest. We got a great, great group of young singles, young couples, young families that love God, are serious about God, serious about spiritual things. I'm so excited for you guys. I mean, you have your whole lives in front of you. I can't wait to see the impact that God's going to use you for in impacting our church, our island, our world. I see that in you, in the ways that God's going to use you. I know this, the depth of your personal spiritual fulfillment and the scope of your spiritual influence is going to be directly related to this idea. The depth of your personal spiritual fulfillment and the scope of your spiritual influence is going to be directly related to this idea. Man, I want to set a dream in front of you. If I can this morning, if you'd allow me to kind of come along beside you and sit down in the chair next to you and sort of put in front of you a life quest, you guys. A life quest of just living your whole life, 40, 50, 60 years in front of you with a focused, passionate, purpose-filled burden to know Christ, to walk with Him for a lifetime, to seek after Him with your whole heart, to reject spiritual complacency at every turn, and asking if you would not settle for a facade of spirituality. You guys getting me? Do not settle for a facade of spirituality that you would experience many, many times throughout the course of your lives, the magnitude of His overcoming power in your personal life, that you would experience again and again, and every time your personal relationship of knowing Christ would grow. I'm praying that. I'm hoping that for you, for many of you, and hopefully not many, but that you would have the privilege of walking through and experiencing the fellowship of His sufferings, and that during these days you would hold fast to these truths and not waver, so that your relationship with God would grow and have life and be real and authentic. It's my prayer for you. I'm asking, I'm placing before you a dream, a life quest, that you would walk with God, desiring to know Christ with your whole life, your whole life. To the rest of us, maybe we don't have 60 years in front of us. Maybe it's 40, or maybe it's 10. But whatever we have, what if we could just commit ourselves to stop wasting any of our energy and passions on any of the stuff that doesn't really matter anyway? Wherever we're at in our path of life, we would just decide here this morning, we'd kind of put a stake in the ground and say, from here on out, for the rest of my days, I'm going to be a seeker of God. I want to know Christ, whatever it takes. Brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind, forget about them, reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. That's my prayer. That's my prayer for you this morning.